Chapter 2, New York Childhood.
Talk about being a kid in the Bronx. Wasn't there a story about your house catching on fire?
I was 8 years old, if I remember correctly. And my kid brother, Marty Zangwill, was 2 years old. And my home was on Sherman Avenue. And the schoolyard was on Sherman Avenue, and the school was recessed back behind the yard. My classes were on the third floor, I think, of the building. So we were up pretty high in terms of a view. And it was a normal class. And then suddenly one of the kids yelled, "There's a fire! There's a fire! Look, I can see a fire! A house is burning!" We all raced to the window, and it was my home. Flames were bursting out of the front of it. And in the aftermath, there wasn't all that much damage done because only the front end of the building was damaged, and the building ran deep. It was a private home. The way the story goes, the story that I was told many times, was that my brother, age two, was looking for something under the sofa and had a book of matches. He lit a match to see where a penny was or something, and that ignited the sofa, and that was the fire.
So the house was fixable.
The house was fixed, yeah. We lived, trying to remember, we lived for about 6 months, I think, with the damage, the open portions covered, and then it all was fixed.
Did they own that house?
My father owned the house, yes. He lost it in the Depression when he no longer could meet the mortgages.
Speaking of the Depression, what did they do to make ends meet? What kind of jobs was he doing?
My father was an artist in the sense that he had studied art and had done some painting, and his profession was as an engraver. He also had a good hand at doing signs. He ended up painting signs for the little, what we now call luncheonettes, on celluloid, and slipped into frames. Prices were changing so fast that they kept wanting to change the sign, and if he did this on celluloid, it could be slid in to a frame, the other one removed. He did that for a long time. Otherwise, he scrounged for whatever he could get. Very often, it was very little. We didn't have anything more than the basics in terms of eating, the family was together. That's about the best way to put it.
But he had some business schemes that you helped him with.
Well, I helped the family out if I could earn some money. And the way I earned money in the days of the Depression, I was born in 1923, so in 33, I was 10 years old, and the height of the Depression was in the years following 33. The beginning, as a 10-year-old, I delivered prescriptions for the drugstore to the neighborhood. There was no pay in this. The drugstore didn't give me anything for it. I did it just for tips. It provided some money. Of course, there wasn't a lot of deliveries that were being made, so that was pretty slim pickings. I also would stand at the subway exit in the Bronx selling Saturday Evening Post and Collier's magazines for a nickel apiece. I got a penny for each one I sold. It was a pretty good evening if I could earn 20 or 22 cents. Spending a couple of hours out at the subway with the magazine bag draped over my shoulder, me flashing the front cover. And in those days, there weren't many people rushing out of the subway to get home who were interested in buying a magazine. But there were a few, and that helped. A little later, I got into selling peanuts and other things, confections At the ballparks, we were just maybe 8 or 10 blocks from the Yankee Stadium where I lived. It was a walk across the bridge to the Polo Grounds. I worked the Yankee Stadium and the Polo Grounds when I could get picked. More often than not, I would go out to the ballpark in the morning, hoping that after the regulars, the vendors, the butcher boys, as they were called, went in and they could assess what the crowd would be like. They would choose supernumeraries. And we were kids and some older folks there. There were older guys there, too, who stood across the street from the players' entrance to the Yankee Stadium. To this day, I remember the guy's name who made the choices after, you know, he'd come gruffly up from his chair, look across the street and say, "You!" And three people within the range of that finger pointing would start running. "No, not you, not you, you!" His name was Barney O'Toole. I can't forget the name. Working the stadium for a ball game was long, long hours. In order to get picked, you had to show up early to show that you were sincere about wanting the job. So I'd show up at the ballpark somewhere around 7 o'clock in the morning. And it wouldn't be until maybe 10 or 11 that you would with a finger pointed at me, would get in. I'd be among the very last to be chosen. Then I sold peanuts mainly. And the routine was you got a uniform, white starched pants and a white jacket and a hat. Before you got the uniform, you went into a dungeon-like area and bagged peanuts, hundreds and hundreds of peanuts in little white bags with a little twist to close them up and put them into a sack to hold the ones ready for sale. All that went on before the game. You get a little time off after you're finished with the peanuts, and then it'd be time, the fans started arriving, and I'd go out into the stands and would walk miles and miles and miles up and down stairs. So it made me the great physical specimen I am today. And the peanuts sold 10 cents a bag. My cut was 1 penny for each bag of peanuts I sold. And the way it was done, money would be passed down the aisle. If a dollar bill was passed down the aisle, you'd give the change to the final guy in the aisle who would pass the money back to the guy and throw him the bag of peanuts. You know, it's a ballpark. Everybody knew how to catch. We did pretty well on most games. I'd earn a buck and a half on a big doubleheader where there are a lot more hours you could be selling. Crowning day would amount to earning $3 in pennies. That was a lot of money then, and my obligation was to give half of it to the household, my contribution, and my mother let me keep half of what I earned. It was always the case, even when I was doing the deliveries of prescriptions, I got to keep half of what I earned. But the incentive to earn was certainly there for two reasons, the family and me. That pretty much was the story, except let me wrap up the ballpark. In the ballpark, after the game, they sold beer and Coke in those days in bottles. And the butcher boys, particularly the oddballs like me, who were lucky to get in, had the job of picking up all the bottles, running through the stands and picking up the bottles and getting them boxed. And then we could go home. So a day at the ballpark on a doubleheader, which, as I say, earned me a maximum of $3, was 7 o'clock in the morning until well after 7 at night.
Wow. So you got to keep half, you'd give half to your mother, and you'd keep half. What were you saving for?
Oh, I'd spend it.
I thought you were going to say something like, oh, my first trumpet or a sports
No,
car.
no. I can't remember if I told you the story of Saturdays in the Bronx as a kid where my mother gave me a quarter for the day, and it was a full-time day thing. I'd go to Needick's, which was a little store that sold hot dogs and orange drink, French fries. They were spread out all over New York. There was one within just a few blocks of where we lived, and I'd go there, and their Saturday special was if you bought a hot dog and a Coke, you got free French fries. The hot dog was a nickel, the Coke was a nickel, and the French fries came free. So there it was for 10 cents.
Not bad.
You ate pretty well, and there's still 15 cents left over. Would then go to the Fleetwood Theater, where on a Saturday matinee, this is right after lunch, we're talking about showing up at the theater at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. There were two first-run movies, short subjects like Fox Movie Tone News and the Three Stooges and Robert Benchley and Pete Smith, and cliffhangers, where the serial would run from week to week, an adventure, 15-minute adventure, wild adventure, comic book stuff, always ending that chapter with the hero about to die and no way out. And the next week, he'd find a way out. But in addition to all of that, there were six acts of vaudeville.
Live.
Live. Yeah, the jugglers and magicians and funny people, more or less. It was a full day.
Wow. And that was 15 cents?
Yeah.
Good Lord. So what did your mother do? She was a housewife. She did she
She was a
work?
housewife.
She didn't
she
work?
I can't remember my mother working on a job. During the Depression, we did take in boarders, and she was responsible for that end of it. She prepared all meals.
Wow.
She did all the laundry. She did everything that needed to be done. She was a hearty soul. She lived to be 98 years old. My father was the wage earner. That's the way it was done.
Where did their parents live?
I didn't know much about my grandparents. I really can't remember ever meeting any of them on either side. I think my father's father was pretty much of a rogue into rabbinical affairs. I don't know much about the Pike background, my mother's parents, other than nothing. I can't remember
Yeah,
anything
it's
about
unu
them.
I it just occurred to me because growing up, I don't think I ever asked about them, but then it suddenly occurred to me,
Yes,
Grandma and Grandpa were children. So they came over with their parents, and it seems like there must have been some kind of immigrant community that they lived in.
the ghetto was the Bronx
So,
well, New York was the ghetto for the Jews, for the Italians, for the Irish.
for all the immigrant, European immigrants.
Mainly, yeah, but they accumulated. The Jews, the Irish, the Italians seemed to end up in pretty much the same thing, with pockets that were more one or the other.
So I'm guessing that they were not close with their parents because
It never was part of my
it
life.
just seems odd to
You'd think
me.
I'd remember it if it
Yeah,
was.
because it seems like if there was a close family, they would have, once they started having children, they would have all, you would have known them. So I'm guessing they didn't.
Lots and lots of children.
Yeah. Talk about your siblings. Sylvia, who's the oldest?
Edith was the
Okay.
oldest, and she was, I recall, 6 years older than me. And then Sylvia came 3 years later, and I came 3 years after that. My brother Mort came 6 years after me. So that's the four. Sylvia was a typical girl of the age. She was liked to dance. She liked to go out. She liked to, food. Everybody had boyfriends, girlfriends. Sylvia ended up with Jack Levy, who turned out to be an absolute prize.
Yeah.
This is one great guy. During World War II, he was a drill sergeant, one tough baby. After the war, his trade was as a beautician and a hairdresser. He had a long, distinguished, and profitable life doing hairdressing. He always prided himself in many of the stars that he did. He did a lot of the women who were in Broadway shows. That was part of the clientele at the beauty parlor where he worked. But his reputation was such that on one occasion, he was called to Washington, D.C. to prepare Lady Bird Johnson's hair for some big occasion. That was the high point of his career as a hairdresser. Edith married Mort. Both of them lived a long, long time. Edith was in her early 90s when she died. Her husband was in his later 90s when he died. And it was a very solid marriage, but nothing flashy. Mort, my brother-in-law, was dedicated to his parents. His father worked many different jobs in the Depression and had his own firm manufacturing lamps. Morty always worked for his father when his father had a business, and his father took a great deal of advantage over him. Edith and Morty never had much, except they had wonderful children. That was the crowning glory of their lives, their kids. My brother Mort was born 6 years after me, and it's kind of sad. He was what they called in those days an unwanted child, in that it had not been planned. He knew it at a very early age that he was an accident. Compounded by other accidents of a physical nature, he had a difficult time of it, and the more success I had, the more difficult it was for him. Just as an aside in all this, of everybody in my family, I'm the only one to have a high school diploma.
Wow.
The girls, Edith and Sylvia, during the Depression, had to go to work.
They dropped out of high school?
They dropped out of high school in order to scrounge what they could in various jobs, some of them menial.
I thought they at least finished high school.
No, no, and my brother didn't. My mother and father never finished high school.
Your brother was younger than you.
6 years younger than me and dropped out of high school.
That wasn't because of the Depression.
Not because of the Depression. More like, I want it now.
That's sad. Tell me about how you became a musician.
I grew up in what we used to affectionately call the concrete jungle of the Bronx. As a kid, it was a normal New York growing up atmosphere. We had street gangs, which were entirely different from what they call gangs today. We were a bunch of Jewish kids who hung around the candy store, talked and boasted and bragged and just generally were a gang of good fellows. There must have been about six, seven, eight of us there. On one of these occasions, a group of us were hanging around the stoop, which were the stairs leading up to the home on Sherman Avenue. I don't know how it came up, but someone said, you know, we ought to have a band. And let's make a band. And then he said, what do you want to play? And what do you want to play? And
did any of these kids have any experience or history with music?
Zero.
It just was like, oh, let's have a band.
Right. Music was good, and, kids
formed. And what was the kind of music that you guys were thinking?
who knows what kind of music? We were simply having a band. Well, and the talk about who was going to play what kicked around back and forth, and I wanted to play drums, except one of the other guys said it first. So what was left was trumpet. So I was destined to become a trumpet player because of that conversation on the stoop. None of us went on to do anything with music very fast. And as it turned out, I think there were maybe six or seven of us who were in that first group. And I think myself and one other guy wasn't all Jewish. This was an Italian guy named Danny Lamort. Danny went on to play saxophone. But he and I were the only ones who went on with music. And it was maybe 6 months later, the opportunity for me to get a trumpet turned up. And lo and behold, thanks to a cousin who had a friend who was a baker who no longer wanted to play trumpet, picked up a Kahn rimless trumpet. I don't know what they sold for in those days, but we got it for $20, which was a bargain.
Was it like a pawn shop instrument? Or
No. This was a private instrument that this baker was a trumpet player who no longer wanted to play trumpet.
Did the rest of the guys that came up with the idea, let's have a band, did they go and get their instruments? Did you guys ever actually have one session where you rehearsed together?
No, there never was any music session. The best I can remember is that only Danny and I got instruments. I was going to Morris High School, and I joined the school band. I practiced diligently and became a fair trumpet player. And I think my first real gig was one summer. We put a group together, a four-piece group, just practicing and horsing around. And we got hired by a resort hotel in the Catskills. Mm. No, it wasn't Grossinger's. And we were hired as a band and as busboys. So we served a double function. During mealtime, we were in the dining room, and in the evening, we played for dancing. And music continued to dominate during my school years, to a point where I really didn't care about anything other than the music.
Wow.
That was one of the reasons that it took me 4.5 years to get out of high school, because my grades were so bad. I was great in music, but that was it.
You were so into music. Who introduced you to the kind of music that was really what grabbed you?
It was the music that kids listened to and young adults listened to at that time.
But there was a lot of jazz and...
A lot of jazz. It was a jazz scene.
Yeah.
And I was in New York, which was the heart of it.
Were you able to get away and see anybody play, anybody famous?
The same group of guys, we used to have a Saturday routine where we would hang around the candy store and say, well, what are you going to do today, Marty? And everybody would dodge, do this, do that. And then so somebody would say, well, we go to the Burlesque down on Broadway. And to the Paramount, afterward, it was in reverse. The Paramount was first and then the Burlesque afterward. And someone would say, well, what do you want to go to the Burlesque for? And there would always be reasons why individuals in this group wanted to go to the Burlesque. This was the Gaiety Burlesque on Broadway. And someone would say, well, the short subjects that they show on the screen, the great Three Stooges and a lot of funny other shorts, that's what I really like. And someone else would say, well, it's the hawkers, the guys who come out and try to sell things in the intermissions. They're always fun to watch. The guy who'd stand on the stage, hold it out on the balcony, stop the sale. I've got a question here in the orchestra concerning the quality of the merchandise we're selling. That it was a pretty lame excuse. And someone else would say it was the comedians, because the burlesque had these skits that ran in between the strips. Well, in any event, that's what we did. We'd go to the Paramount Theater, back to music, where there was a first run film that was presented and a big band. I saw Benny Goodman there, I saw Tommy Dorsey there, I saw any number of other big bands of the day. They would start at 10 o'clock in the morning with the movie. You would sit through the movie, and then the stage below the screen would rise with the big band already set up on it and playing. They'd start playing just as soon as the stage would start going up, and you had an hour concert. I remember seeing Frank Sinatra singing with Tommy Dorsey at one of those sessions later on, of course. After that, we would go to the Gaiety Delicatessen, which was next door to the Gaiety Burlesque. It was one of the great Jewish delicatessens in New York. And then we'd go to the burlesque. And so it was a complete day. We'd leave home at maybe 8 o'clock in the morning to be sure to get good seats at the Paramount. And we'd get back maybe 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening.
So, did you ever get a chance to meet any of the musicians?
Not at that time, no. It was much later that after I was already getting established as a trumpet player, that I used to hang around the Hotel Pennsylvania, and Glenn Miller played a number of well, over a lot of years, he played. I forget what they called it at the time. It was what was it that Benny Goodman, the Manhattan Room.
Oh, yeah. You did
Anyhow,
write about that.
anyhow, I got to know some of the musicians in Miller's band. During intermissions, they'd come out, and I got to know Johnny Best, who was in the trumpet section, and he kind of took a liking to me and agreed to help me with my trumpet playing. I'm guessing about this, but I think that somewhere in his past, some very, very nice trumpet player took him, Johnny Best, under his wing and made him into the great trumpeter that he turned out to be. His most outstanding solo with Glenn Miller recorded was on Stardust. The trumpet solo on Stardust is Johnny Best. Anyhow, Johnny invited me over to his hotel on Sunday mornings, and we'd go down to the basement, and he'd have music. Some of it was from the book, from the Miller book. I'd play along with him off the sheets. That went on for a couple of months. It was a wonderful time, and I got a great deal out of it. The only other big names that I ever played with. When I was at Syracuse University and had a band there, the band On a Lark went up to Montreal, where we had some music friends, a guy by the name of Irv Paul. He took us out on the town to some jazz joints, I mean really joints. And I got to sit in with a kid piano player. He couldn't have been any more than 17 years old, Oscar Peterson.
Wow.
Me and a couple of other guys in the band sat in with him. He was just starting his career. And the only other time I ever played with anyone of note was when I came home from the service after injuries, and it was before I was discharged. I was at the Cafe Society downtown in Greenwich Village in New York, where Lester Young and a group of guys that were mainstays in the jazz field, some of them out of the Basie band. This was after Lester Young had left Basie. I was on crutches, and the trumpet player, we started talking, and he said, "Man," he said, "I got to do something for the service." He said, "I'd like to sit in." He handed his trumpet to me, and I played a tune with Lester Young and this superb group of musicians at the Cafe Society downtown. That's it for my jazz greatness.
Wow. Were you nervous?
I don't think so.
It's hilarious.
Opportunity and you jump.
One of the stories that you tell in your book is a story about Mickey's. What are Mickey's?
One of the things we did for amusing and engaging ourselves in the evenings, the boys, the gang, there were empty lots in the neighborhood where we lived, and it was a fairly frequent event of lighting a fire in a controlled small burn fire in a pit in an empty lot on the days when we could swipe some potatoes, put the potatoes down first and then build the fire over them in the pit. And by the time the fire was burned down completely, or enough that we could get at the potatoes, they were absolutely charred black. If you cut them open, they were milky, creamy inside. But I never really knew why they were called Mickey's until much, much later in life it struck me that this must be a swipe at our Irish group, the guys in the group that were Irish. The slang word for them, they were Micks. And with the potato famine in Ireland, somehow the whole thing settled down into what we cooked under the fire in a vacant lot. This charred remains of a potato was a Mickey.
This concludes Chapter 2.